Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this first Physics World weekly podcast of 2020, and indeed of the new decade. In this week's episode, we look forward to the future of physics, and also to the future of personal audio entertainment, with the help of my colleagues Mateen Durrani and Margaret Harris. Hi, and Happy New Year to both of you.
Hi, Hamish.
Happy New Year, Hamish.
Now, Margaret has managed to get hold of a set of really nice-looking and sounding graphene-based headphones, and we'll talk about those a bit later. But first, let's delve into Mateen's predictions of what physics in the new decade could bring. Now, Mateen, you're optimistic about the next 10 years of physics, aren't you? Why are you so cheery?
Well, if you told me 10 years ago that we would have a set of graphene headphones on our tables at the start of the new decade, I wouldn't have believed you. So who knows where the next 10 years are going ahead? And, you know, that's the beauty of science, is that it's always progressing and there's always something new around the corner. And so whatever else is happening in the world, there's always something exciting happening in physics.
And in your piece, we're talking about a piece that Mateen's written that you can read on the Physics World website. You point out that physics will continue to improve a wide range of technologies. I suppose graphene headphones are one of them. But do you have any specific predictions for what sort of new physics technologies could benefit humans in the coming decade?
Well, I have to preface, anything I say is probably utter rubbish, and anyone who makes predictions about the future is always...
It's a complete mug's game, isn't it?
It's a mug's game. You know, back in the early 60s, people were... I read one thing recently that by now, we'd all be having artificially engineered animals doing our grunt work. Artificial monkeys and apes would be doing the work, so that obviously hasn't happened. Those visions of fusion-powered cars flying through the air, although we're getting near to drones, so maybe that's... not too far off, but yeah, it's a mug's game, as Margaret says. So yeah, preface anything I say with probably don't believe anything that I'm about to say over the next few minutes. But yeah, technology, I did mention improvements in smartphones. I mean, that's one thing that has really come on in leaps and bounds. So I guess smaller, lighter, faster, thinner smartphones.
Were smartphones around 10 years ago? I find it really difficult to sort of gauge.
10 years ago, yeah, they were, but not 15. Yeah, there's a lot of things that happened that kind of 5 years from the mid-2000s to the late-2000s.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, smartphones are incredible. You know, the amount of processing power that you have in your pocket, and the high quality of the screen, and the fact that when we were listening to those headphones, I think everybody was going through their phone, weren't they?
Streaming
audio and using Bluetooth to connect to the headphones. So yeah, it's I suppose that's an example of lots and lots of interesting physics in a very small package. But
although I'm not sure that they're that small, actually, because I have to pick a bone with smartphone manufacturers here, because I'm a woman and women's clothing is not designed with very big pockets. And finding a phone that actually fits in my pocket is a real challenge. They all seem to be getting bigger rather than smaller. So please, here's my New Year's wish. Someone sell a decent phone that will fit in a woman's pockets. That would be great.
Yeah, they are getting bigger, aren't they? I mean, if you cast your mind back to the beginning of the decade,
when little Nokia things,
really
the size
tiny,
of candy bars.
Exactly. Yeah,
but one of those.
Yeah, I suppose it's unrealistic to have all the bells and whistles in such a tiny package.
Mind you, whether it's my eyesight going, my phone here in front of me on the desk is pretty large. Would you say, Margaret?
Do you have a large type hand span sort of width. But you've got bigger pockets, so
So you're pretty bullish on quantum technologies, Mateen. Do you think in 10 years' time your phone will have a quantum computer inside it?
Ooh, now that's a very good question. I mean, yeah, quantum tech has really come along in a long way, and we're sort of nearing the stage where these things are entering the minds of business executives as real products, and that's been really exciting over the last 10 years. I think in terms of research, I can see potentially, you know, quantum computing becoming something that people actually use to perform new research, rather than it just being a field of research. So I'll put my neck on the line there that it might create some new results.
So quantum computers used, well, essentially as simulators to sort of simulate physical systems, often quantum systems that we can't that we find very difficult to model using conventional computers.
Yeah, and Margaret, you've also written about accessing quantum computers via the cloud.
Yeah, I think
to me that sounds quite realistic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the answer to whether you'll have a quantum computer in your pocket, in your smartphone, is I think a definite no. I'm going to stick my neck out and say no. But if you can access a quantum computer via the cloud with, you know, 5G internets and this sort of thing, you don't kind of need, in fact, you wouldn't want a dilution refrigerator in your pocket. Not even men's pockets are going to fit that. But so I think, yes, exactly. If it's accessible by the cloud, it'll be accessible to more researchers. Whether it'll be used for sort of more commercial applications, I think I'm going to step back and plead no contest to that.
And as staying on the sort of computing front, Mateen, you've also mentioned machine learning and artificial intelligence, and these are, of course, you know, real technologies that are being applied. I mean, it seems that physicists are finding new applications for these every day. And so you think that that by the time 2030 rolls around, that they'll be a really important part of physics research.
Yeah, that's one of my predictions. I mean, I've got no particular evidence to back that up other than, you know, we've all seen an increasing number of research papers where people are using machine learning or artificial intelligence to do real research. And I think that'll be more and more the case in the future, that that's the way things are going, especially with a huge amount of data from a lot of experiments. People will find clever ways of analyzing that.
And I mean, there's such a wide range of possibilities, isn't there? I mean, you could use it in particle physics to analyze data from a detector at the LHC. You could use it to look at lots and lots of different combinations of atoms that you could put together to make a material with a specific property that you want. I mean, it seems that the applications are endless. I suppose it'll be interesting to see that, you know, if we've got enough computing power in the future for all these applications. But machine learning and AI could be very interesting. And I think, I mean, if I can make a prediction, I'm guessing that there'll be applications of those technologies that we haven't thought of yet.
I think we're on pretty safe ground saying that those things dominate the direction of travel as it is now. But I'm not sure we know what the destination is going to be. You know, in physics, every vector has a magnitude and a direction. I think we know the direction. Maybe the magnitude's a little bit less predictable.
And Mateen, you also highlight environmental concerns and how they could impact on how physicists work. I mean, I think an obvious example of that is researchers cutting down on international travel, so not going to as many conferences by airplane and maybe attending remotely, that sort of thing. But there are other ways that physicists and other scientists can reduce their carbon footprints, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, that's the trend is towards, well, I hope it'll be a trend over the next 10 years, is to have laboratories being much greener. And that's something we covered last year, and it's not something I previously thought much about, but certainly there must be a lot of scope for making physics laboratories greener, whether it's, you know, turning equipment off, reusing or recycling that equipment, sharing it among different groups so that it's used rather than sat unattended and unused for a lot of the time. Even simple things like refrigerators being turned off when they're not in use, or having an inventory of what's in your fridge so that you're not cooling samples that don't need to be cooled, that kind of thing. There's probably a lot of low-hanging fruit, if I can use that cliche, to make energy savings in labs.
And a big one are fume hoods, aren't there, which are essentially sucking air out of buildings continuously. And of course, if you're using lots of energy to cool your building or heat your building in the winter, and all of that energy is just going out the roof via the fume hood that isn't being used but left on, that could be a problem as well, couldn't it? That could be easily fixed.
Yeah, a few years ago, I remember going to one of the laboratories at the University of Bristol, I think in life sciences, and it was an amazing building, looked fantastic. And I said to the guy who was the building manager, who was one of the researchers there, about how wonderful it looked. And he said to me, well, it looks wonderful, but, you know, this is only meant to last 40 years. And the energy cost of building a building that's going to be pulled down in 40 years seems crazy, but it's a short-term thing. It's probably cheaper to build a building that has a short lifespan, so your budget to build it is lower. But if you built something that was meant to last for longer, it would be more expensive short term, but ultimately would make savings because you're not knocking it down, building another one with a load more steel beams and all the rest of it.
That's an interesting issue. Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm guessing part of the problem is not knowing what your needs are going to be in 40 years. You could build a building that's meant to last forever. But if it's not fit for purpose in 40 years, you know.
It'll get pulled down anyway, won't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, here in Bristol, we're surrounded by, sort of office blocks that were put up in the 60s, aren't we? And, they're all being torn down and being replaced with new buildings because they're not fit for purpose. But then, you think of a building like the... The Pantheon in Rome that started off as a temple and then became a Catholic church, etc. Very cleverly repurposed. That is an interesting one. And there are some things that sort of make us chuckle, aren't there? Like, for example, CERN. Years ago, CERN used to brag about how much electricity it used to run the accelerator. But of course now, they don't brag.
A little quieter about that, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. And I know that, at CERN they are trying to cut down on the huge amounts of energy that they use to cool and run the LHC.
I suppose that takes us on to kind of the next topic, which is about like big physics projects. Will the designers of the next, next collider have to think much more carefully about the environmental concerns of making it? Is that a possibility?
It's always hard to say. I mean, if you're faced with limited budget, well, where are you going to, what are you going to do to, focus your money on? Sometimes you don't have the money for more ambitious projects that might save money long term, but short term cost more. So it's difficult. But yeah, in terms of future big science projects, Hamish, that's always slightly easier to predict where things are going because big science projects have a long plan and they're in the works and they've been planned for many years. So there are three things that I'm quite clear will happen. One is the James Webb Space Telescope, after many delays, should take off. I mean, it's planned for next year, 2021. And I think that's something like the 15th delay,
It's been nicknamed the Just Wait Telescope.
Telescope. So
that's is that a replacement to the Hubble?
Yeah.
Is that the
successor,
way to think about it?
I think, rather replacement.
Right.
And one of the exciting things there is it's got this amazingly complicated mirror that has to unfurl when it's up in space. And it's a one-time shot, and I think they've practiced that in the lab, but, a lot of hearts will be in mouths when that happens to make sure it works.
So is that the sort of origami-based solution?
That's quite exciting, just from the sort of visual and sort of thrill point of view. So two other things. The ITER fusion experiment, which is being built in southern France, they're talking about having their first plasma by the middle of the decade.
So what does that mean? That's not achieving their goal of fusion, getting started, is it?
So I think that means having your raw material, your fusion fuel, heated up to a very hot temperature so that it's ionized. I think even trying to get fusion reactions happening would be after that, and getting more energy out than you put in would even be 10 years beyond that.
And the ultimate goal of ITER is not to be a proto power plant, is it? That
would be the next thing.
It's right. To study it, yeah.
Yeah. And then, the other big thing is the CERN Particle Physics Lab in Geneva. They're planning their high luminosity upgrade, which I think is planned for 2026. That civil engineering work, I was there last year, that had already started. There's another run. There's a current shutdown, there'll be another run, and then after that, that'll when the experiments will get renewed and the upgrade to the accelerator will happen. So that's something to watch out for the middle of the decade.
And diversity is something that you've also highlighted in your crystal ball looking towards the next decade. I'm guessing that you're hoping and predicting that the diversity in terms of who is a physicist at all levels of career is better than it is today.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of efforts over the last few years, and I think those will sort of finally come to fruition. And I didn't want to predict that there'll be more fraction of women in physics, but I think certainly the proportion of women at the top of the tree will go up, and you'll have more people at senior positions who are women by the end of the decade than there are now. But certainly I think physics will be a more diverse community. I hope so. That'd be great to see.
I think we all hope so, because it's important for that the most talented people, no matter who they are and what their background is, are able to succeed in the field and persist in the field. But I have to say I'm a lot more pessimistic than you are, because numbers, particularly for women, have remained flat for about the past 30 years. And so I think it's a triumph of hope over expectation to think that's going to change enormously. And whatever I say about women in physics is true double and treble and quintuple for racial minorities in physics, including women. But I guess the fragment of hope I had is that we're actually talking about it a lot more than we were sort of maybe even 10 years ago. So hopefully some of that talk that I think has been really positive will actually translate into action.
I mean, when you look back at old issues of Physics Bulletin, which was the predecessor to Physics World, a lot of the research, you know, hasn't kind of changed all that much, but it's the social element of physics that changes a huge amount, and some of the letters that people wrote in and the topic, the culture of physics, when you read those letters from 30, 40 years ago, you know, that's where you think how much has changed. And, you know, I would imagine further changes in that direction in the future. So actually, I think the culture of physics has changed a lot more than maybe the research field itself.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we'll see more of that in future.
And I think we've got a bit of news coming up shortly, don't we? Our colleague Michael Banks is looking into a report from the U.S. about minority participation in physics. So keep an eye out for that. That'll be on the website shortly. So those are Mateen's picks. So, Margaret, do you have any specific hopes or predictions for the coming decade?
Well, I think I mentioned diversity as a hope, as I said, more in hope than expectation. And then also, Mateen kind of stole mine when he talked about the rise of quantum technologies. I'm really, really keen to see this, what has been a research field that I was kind of on the edges of 15 years ago or so, turn into more like an industry and something that, you know, if it doesn't turn up in people's pockets, at least becomes a bigger factor in their lives. It'll be interesting, I think, to see whether the hype about quantum computers and quantum technologies generally gets translated into real things, or whether there's a bit of a bubble that we're coming up to. And then we go talk about the peak of expectations and the trough of disappointment and this sort of thing. I think, actually, if you look back to graphene, which is what we'll be talking about with the headphones shortly, there was a bit of a bubble, a peak of expectations around graphene. And we're now, kind of 15 years after it's being discovered, starting to see some applications coming through. We may have the same thing happen with quantum technologies.
I suppose the thing that I'm really looking forward to in the next decade, and you know, I hope it's going to happen, is someone is going to discover solid evidence for life on another planet. You know, that could be, I don't know, maybe it'll be Mars, and maybe it'll be that there was life on Mars, or maybe even more excitingly that, you know, there's evidence for life on a distant exoplanet, a planet orbiting a star other than the sun. So, I'm looking forward to that, and I'm hoping that that's something that'll happen in the next decade. Any other thoughts, Mateen? Any last-minute additions to your list of things to look out for in the future?
Well, in terms of clean energy technology, you know, I would love progress in fusion power to be much quicker. And there are a lot more smaller independent companies on the scene that are trying to sort of steal the thunder of in fusion science and trying innovative new techniques that don't involve, the going down the giant ITER experiment route as in France. So I think, you know, those small firms, you know, I think there'll be more of those, and exciting to see what they're up to, and can they make progress, and can they do innovative things, and can
they make money?
Can they make money? can they do something clever? You know, because fusion power, when you think about it, I read in one of your articles, Margaret, the energy density of a fusion material is a million times that of a fossil fuel. And when you think a million times the energy density in a sort of gram of fuel, you know, it seems a no-brainer to want to pursue that as a dream. And, you know, if that can come to reality, and it's something that very closely linked to physics, you know, that would be fantastic.
Well, that's related to another upcoming story I think that we've got, and this is about is a now defunct facility in the desert in the U.S.
Oh,
Margaret,
yeah.
you've actually flown over it.
Okay, so this is not fusion. This is solar thermal energy, where the general idea is you've got, rather than solar panels, solar photovoltaic panels that convert sunlight into electricity, you actually have mirrors sometimes that sort of beam the light onto some sort of central thing that gets heated up, typically turning something into molten salt, which takes a long time to cool down and has a high energy density. And then you use the molten salt to, in the same way you use any hot substance, to drive a turbine and generate electricity that way. And several years ago, I was flying back from the, using up my carbon footprint there, flying back from Photonics West in California. And I was looking out down the Nevada desert, as you do when you're flying across the US. And I thought, you know, what the heck is that? There was this really bright, perfect circle of mirrors on the ground. And I knew immediately that it must be some sort of solar insulation, and it is, and it's a complete white elephant. It is not really functioning, it's not running, it's not economical, it seemed like the future. At the moment, it doesn't look like it's going to be the future anytime soon.
And that's because the solar cell technology,
photovoltaic
technology, is just so good now.
So much cheaper,
no point. So, yeah, there's an interesting example of maybe an idea that people would have been talking about maybe two decades ago.
Well, they probably still are. And there's every possibility that it might come back at some point in the future, you know, to exploit some fraction of the solar market that photovoltaics can't touch, or for niche applications, or there could be some breakthrough that could bring it back again. Everything old is new again.
So who would build that, Margaret?
I can't remember the name of the company, but I think it's a company that is nobody wants to be associated with right now. I read an article this week saying that politicians used to be really happy to be photographed with it. Now they're kind of like, we don't know you. So
you can read more about Mateen's vision of the future in the analysis section of the Physics World website. Now, over the holidays, Margaret received a belated Christmas gift: a pair of high-end graphene-based headphones. Now, it wasn't Santa who brought them. Where did these headphones come from, Margaret?
Well, first I have to stop you there. It wasn't actually a Christmas gift. I don't get to keep the headphones. In fact, I have, at this minute, as we're recording this, have packed them back to the manufacturer with thank you for letting us have a go at trying them. So these are headphones sold by a Canadian startup called Aura Sound. And as we've implied, they actually have graphene in them. Now, if we take a little bit of a detour, when do you guys think that the first headphones were made? Just a quick question, put you on the spot.
First headphones?
1890. Okay.
Oh, I'll go with 1905.
Hamish is definitely closer. So their first commercial pair were sold in 1910, which is 10 years after radio waves were first used commercially by Marconi. And since then, there have actually been relatively, if you look at a photo of the headphones from 1910, they are recognizably headphones, I guess because the human anatomy hasn't changed that much. So the changes that have happened have been, you know, miniaturization. You get earbuds were all the rage sort of 15 years ago with Apple's first iPod. You got the turn these over-the-ear models that Callum, our producer, is sporting at the moment. And from the outside, they don't look all that different to the ones you see people wearing in films from the 1980s or before, or maybe you grew up with if you're older. They're different on the inside because they use digital signal processing, but the technology at the heart hasn't changed. What you're hearing is a sound wave made by a membrane that's vibrating tens or thousands of times a second. Now, in most headphones, that membrane is made of some type of plastic or cellulose, which is thin, light, and relatively tough. But in the headphones we tested, it's made of a proprietary material called graphene Q that is more than 95% graphene oxide.
So in this case, the graphene is actually doing the work.
Doing the work,
it's
yeah.
not just
yeah.
there for show.
It's not just there for show, at least they say it's not. The idea is that graphene, being very light and very strong, much lighter and stronger than industry standard membranes, means that they warp less as they vibrate, which is good because warping distorts the sound. And also, in principle, it means they don't take as much energy to make the membranes move, meaning your battery might last longer.
And so, Margaret, you had a listen to some music on these headphones, and you also passed them around the office, didn't you? And quite a few of us had a go at doing a mini review. So, what did people think?
Well, I think I was interested in doing this because, you know, okay, there's this principle that graphene would make a better membrane, but in fact, the designers of headphones need to consider a whole bunch of things. Like, you might think that a flat sonic response across the range of vibration frequencies would be good, but that would be ignoring the fact that our ears haven't evolved that way. We're good at sensing the frequencies of human speech, not so good at the low and high. And of course, high frequencies get harder to hear as you get older. Plus, of course, our ears aren't some sort of, you know, extraneous thing. They're attached to and inside our skulls, and that affects how we hear things. As, of course, anyone who's ever listened to recording themselves will know. So the question was, would all this stuff come together and would you actually be able to hear a difference with these graphene-containing headphones? And I can't say it was definitely necessarily the graphene that did it, but they were certainly a lot better than the headphones I'm used to hearing. So the high frequencies were much clearer. The bass felt more solid. That was my verdict, anyway. You had a go at them.
Yeah, I listened to two pieces of music that I'm familiar with. One was "So What," which is on the Kind of Blue album by Miles Davis, and that was really interesting because in that song there's a lot of distortion of Miles Davis's trumpet, and that's sort of the style that he plays
in.
Deliberate distortion, yeah. And it was really, really clear. It's the first time that I've really appreciated, you know, the distortion and how clear it is. So I was really impressed by that. And the other song that I listened to is a song called "Fearless" by Pink Floyd, and that was interesting because at the end of the song they sample. I think this is probably an early example of sampling. This is a off an album from the 1970s, a recording of the Liverpool Cop. So that's Liverpool football fans singing "You'll Never Walk Alone," and for the first time, I could really hear the lyrics, you know, get a good idea of what the lyrics were. You could almost hear individual voices in this big crowd of people in Liverpool football ground. Is it Anfield?
Anfield.
Is that what it's called? Anfield football ground. And I thought that was really interesting as well. So, it was on listening to two pieces of music. It was a revelation. So,
but the headphones you normally have, Hamish, are those really cheap ones you got on the plane to Canada once. So how do you know that the headphones aren't good just because they're higher quality headphone, full stop?
Oh, yeah. That's true, yeah. I mean, I've never owned a decent pair of headphones.
But we did actually try out the headphones. We asked some of the wider members of the Physics World team to try out the headphones, some including some people who actually are familiar with really good headphones. And I think several of them were actually quite impressed by it. They said it was as good as the, you know, the high end pair of headphones that they listened to at home. There were some comments, you know, felt they were a little bit heavy, possibly, as in the weight of them. And I don't think Sarah Tesh was terribly impressed. So she was thought the high end sounded a little bit tinny, but, you know, each their own. And Sarah does have younger ears than the rest of us, so that may be a part of the reason.
What about you, Mateen? Did you give them a thumbs up?
Well, I was just flicking through all my incredibly dodgy songs on my Spotify playlist, and I said to Margaret, there's one I listened to was by Mika, who had a hit album in 2008, and there's just happened to be a song called Billy Brown, where he's got quite a strong vocal. I think he sings in the kind of guise of Freddie Mercury. I think he models himself on Freddie Mercury, and his voice was really clear, and you had a real sort of 3D depth to the music, which that could just be because the headphones were just better quality full stop, and it could be because of the graphene, but...
Yeah, I found that as well.
A clarity and a sort of, you could hear things in the distance, quieter sounds, louder sounds. It was a very pleasurable listening experience. So yeah, I gave it full marks for that.
So Margaret, this isn't the only graphene product available. There are tennis rackets and other things you can buy.
Yeah, so don't bother sending me a tennis racket. I'm useless at tennis. I won't be able to give you any sort of good review at all. But tennis rackets were actually the first commercial product to contain graphene. That's according to Konstantin Novoselov, who was one of the co-discoverers or pioneers of graphene. And then they've cropped up in a number of other things: high-end sporting goods, bicycle wheels, fishing rods, I think, motorcycle helmets. And they're also starting to crop up as well in sort of less flashy but potentially more impactful applications such as additives to paint, so anti-corrosion paint, which exploits the sort of conductive properties of graphene as opposed to the mechanical properties of graphene, which are tend to be the ones that are exploited in these headphone membranes and also in the tennis rackets.
Because I remember writing about those tennis rackets in 2013, and as far as I remember, it was all about, it wasn't that the racket was made of graphene, it was something to do with the graphene allowed the mass distribution in the racket to be altered, because I think you don't want a uniform mass distribution in the racket. I think you want more, you want it heavier density in the racket part than in the other bit. Something to do with how the mass distribution in the racket, and somehow the graphene additive allowed them to fine tune that better.
At least that was the marketing copy.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's what, if you check my blog from yonks ago, you'll, there's something about that. But that was 2013, and there was a, I remember going to a big meeting in London all about applications of graphene, and there were things like, you know, dashboards in lorries and vans and cars and made entirely from 2D graphene screens, that, you know, all these crazy things, and things like planes, you could have braking brakes made from planes because they take the heat away faster, and all sorts of applications that may or may never come to pass.
Panels in planes, because graphene again is very electrically conductive, so if something an airplane gets struck by lightning, it can spread the charge more easily, that sort of thing. I think there's also a huge issue about that is starting to be addressed about, you know, if this thing contains graphene, how do you know and that it really does, and how do you know what type of graphene it has in there and whether it makes any difference? Because it's one thing to sort of say, oh, this tennis racket has graphene in it, and maybe it sort of really does help the performance, maybe it's just a gimmick, but, you know, a lot of people buying really high-end products are doing it because they're really high-end products and status. They don't necessarily care that the graphene is doing anything. But if you're going to come to something, you know, like protecting a wind turbine from corrosion, you really want to know that there is actually graphene in that paint and that it's doing what the company says it's going to do. So I think there's a real place, and it's starting to be recognized, for regulators to come in and say, you know, this is the type of graphene that's in this, and it really is what it says it is.
The problem is for researchers, they can get really excited about the product they've made and the exciting science about it. But, you know, for the public, unless it meets the need of that, if it meets the requirement of people, it's not going to work. And if it's not priced competitively, and if it doesn't break down, and if it doesn't do all sorts of things beyond just the research excitement, then it's not going to succeed. And you know, one hopes that graphene will, these headphones will work, but there's no guarantee. And fair play to companies who are brave enough to enter the sort of rat race of marketing their products, because it's pretty dicey whether you'll actually make money out of this. So let's hope it succeeds, but who knows.
I mean, it is. I do find it interesting that a lot of the applications for graphene at the moment tend to be structural.
Yeah, they're material science applications rather than physics applications, yeah.
Whereas, you know, here at Physics World, as physicists, we tend to think of graphene as this exciting, electronic nanomaterial, you know, that can that can be a superconductor or a Mott insulator, or, you know, be used to make a new type of transistor. And you know, maybe that'll happen in the future. But it is interesting that the structure of graphene seems to be the thing that people are using. And I suppose there's other applications like water purification, simply taking advantage of the fact that you can poke a tiny hole into graphene to let the water through, but not contaminants. So yeah, graphene, that's definitely something to look forward to. New graphene technologies in the 2020s. And as you say, Margaret, I have to say you had a very sad look on your face when you were taping up that box to send it back to Canada.
Yeah, well, the headphones have gone back now. Hopefully they'll arrive safely. And we do thank Aura for letting us test them out, even though we had to give them back.
And you can read lots more about the headphones on the website. You've written a blog about it,
yep.
And there's some great comments from many of our colleagues who have tested the headphones. So finally, to end the podcast, I thought we could have a chat about a few of our favorite articles that have gone up on the website recently. And I think one of my favorite articles over the past week or so is an article written by Ian Randall that's called "Ancient Art of Cheese Tapping Mimicked by Digital Signal Processing."
Okay, so I'll buy it. What is cheese tapping, Hamish?
This is about a new automated technique for working out if a wheel of semi-hard cheese is ripe. And perhaps the most familiar example of this type of cheese is Swiss Emmental, which is famous for its holes. And it's the holes that are the challenge for cheesemakers. The thing is, if you don't let the cheese age long enough, you don't get the holes. And, you know, you don't want Emmental cheese without any holes in it. But if you take too long, if you allow the cheese to ripen for too long, these holes get very big and they join up and the cheese will just collapse in on itself. So the art of the cheesemaker is to work out exactly when the cheese is ready to be eaten. And this can be done in two ways. One way is to take core samples of the cheese. So cut out a bit of the cheese and have a look at it. But the problem with that, of course, is that you're eating into your profits.
Literally.
Quite literally, yeah. And the other way of doing it is tapping. So the idea is that someone who's very skilled can tap an Emmental cheese and decide whether it's ripe, you know, whether it has the right distribution of holes and holes of the right size. But these people are highly skilled, and you know, I suppose not every cheesemaker has access to a highly skilled cheese tapper.
Yeah, go on.
And so in the news article, Ian Randall describes how researchers in Uruguay have automated the process by analyzing the tapping sounds using digital signal processing.
Were they wearing graphene headphones when they did it?
Well, I suppose that would be the next stage in the research. So not gooda news for cheese tappers.
No, come on, I've got to tell my cheese. Can I tell my cheese joke?
Okay.
Yes,
I've got a cheese grater that belonged to Hitler and Stalin. It was the greater of two evils.
Oh, God.
So,
next.
Get your coat, Mateen. It's where you're done.
Not good news for cheese tappers, who could face the next decade with the prospect of being replaced by digital technology.
I don't know where we're going with this, Hamish. But yeah, the other news story from the week was about gravitational waves. They're back in the news again, aren't they? This was something to do with a gravitational wave signal that we reported on in April and August last year, but there's been a bit of an update on it, hasn't there?
Yes, this is a signal that was spotted on the 25th of April, 2019. And there was a bit of, a bit of an argument or a bit of a mystery as to exactly what created this gravitational wave signal. But astrophysicists working on the LIGO and Virgo gravitational wave detectors have now decided that it was created by the merger of two neutron stars. And so that would make it only the second neutron star merger to be observed. The first was observed in 2017, and that was definitely a big deal. Now, this one is interesting for a number of reasons, the second one. First is that it was only seen by one of three gravitational wave detectors that are operational on Earth, and that's the LIGO detector in Livingston, Louisiana. The reason is that the other LIGO detector in Washington was turned off, and the Virgo detector in Italy didn't see it for some reason.
Not that it wasn't working.
No. Well, we think it's often the case of the because these gravitational waves are positioned in different places on Earth, and depending on how the gravitational wave travels through Earth, it's possible for, you know, one of the detectors just not to be sensitive to it.
Right.
And that, of course, gives you useful information because you know where.
More about where it came from.
Exactly, it gives you a bit more directionality. Unlike the 2017 event, no electromagnetic radiation was seen. And you sort of expect that when two neutron stars collide, there's a huge amount.
You get a whole load of other radiation.
Exactly, yeah. And that was seen in the first 2017 detection. But recently, there was a paper, a preprint that was published on Archive a week or so ago, where some Russian astronomers have reported the observation of two gamma ray bursts. And they say these were detected by the Integral satellite observatory, and they came sort of a second or so after the gravitational waves. Right. So it is possible that some electromagnetic radiation was observed.
So this particular collision wasn't a neutron star and a black hole. It was two neutron stars colliding. That's the consensus.
I think so. The thing that is also really interesting about this event is that apparently the mass of the object that was created after the collision, so this is whatever the two neutron stars created after they collided and merged, has a mass of about 3.4 suns. And this is much heavier than the largest known neutron star binary systems in the Milky Way. And these weigh in at about 2.9 solar masses. So this is heavier than expected. But I'm pretty sure that this didn't happen in the Milky Way. So does this suggest that we can't apply observations in the Milky Way to events that happen outside of the Milky Way? Initially there was some speculation because of this heavy mass that it was a neutron star and a black hole that had been that had collided or merged, but this has been ruled out. So, the bottom line here is that LIGO and Virgo have made yet another surprising discovery, and hopefully this will shed further light on the lives and deaths of stars. And I'm writing a news story about that as we speak. Well, when I get
not
back
literally
to
as you speak, no, you're no, talking no. Unless you're multitasking.
When I get back to my desk, and that will be on the website before this goes out tomorrow.
Brilliant! I look forward to that.
Well, I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Margaret Harris and Mateen Durrani for being with me, and a special thank you to our producer Callum Jelf, who is not wearing graphene headphones because Margaret did send them back.
Honest.
Yeah, really did.
And remember, if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.